Coke, Pepsi, and Dr. Pepper spent more than $10 million trying unsuccessfully to defeat a sugary drinks tax in Philadelphia. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. More than 1 month after it was signed into law by Mayor Jim Kenney, we're just learning about the donors who supported the tax. WHYY's Katie Culinary learned that one of the biggest givers to the pro-tax camp is a member of the board serving as Philadelphia's fiscal watchdog. Katie, who is Michael Karp?
Michael Karp is a wealthy donor who's given to Republican and Democratic candidates over the years, and he made a lot of his money in real estate in University City. And for a long time, he's been one of the five members of the Pennsylvania Intergovernmental Cooperation Authority, or PICA. It's often referred to as the city's fiscal watchdog. And the PICA board has to approve Philadelphia's budget and five-year plan in order for the city to get state funding. Documents show, and Karp confirmed to us, that he gave $25,000 to Philadelphians for a Fair Future, the nonprofit that put out ads and rallied community groups in favor of the tax, which is a key component of this year's budget and the five-year plan.
Begging the key question, is it a conflict of interest for a PICA member to give money to a cause like this?
Right. That is the big question, Dave. And I spoke to David Thornburg. He's with the Good Government Group Committee of 70. And he said it doesn't look entirely good.
PICA is intended to be kind of an independent voice that ultimately approves the city's taxing and spending plans. And here was a proposal to change Philadelphia's taxes. Obviously, there were some folks felt one way or the other, but the fact that a member of this body was, in fact, supporting one side just feels a little odd.
As Thornburg pointed out, Karp doesn't necessarily stand to benefit personally from the soda tax revenue, but it is questionable whether an official in his position can objectively review the mayor's spending plans, given that he supported it with his cash.
To which Karp responds,
he doesn't think it's a conflict of interest. Karp told me PICA has a really simple mission.
We're not recommending or supporting any specific program. We're looking only at whether the total of all revenue numbers versus the total of all expenditures come in with a balanced number. So we're not looking at any specific program. We're just looking at the bottom line.
But if you remember, a lot of the soda tax debate was centered on whether it would actually deliver the revenue the mayor's office was saying it was going to pay for these programs, expanding pre-K, community schools, and this big overhaul of parks and rec centers.
What motivated Michael Karp to give to the effort?
It's not clear whether Mayor Kenney asked him to give, but it is clear that Michael Karp has strong feelings about soda and its effects on health, especially the health of children. Case in point, when I first reached him by email last night, he sent me back a link to a video made by BuzzFeed of people who like to drink soda checking out what happens if you leave a human tooth in a vial of soda for 5 days.
Ah, this is not good. What is it? Is it a tooth? Ew, ew!
The teeth go from white to brown, and you can hear the reactions there.
Ew.
Karp told me that he doesn't allow his children to drink soda. He didn't allow them growing up, only on special occasions like birthdays. And this is not Karp's first foray into the soda wars. He was a member of the Board of Education back in 2000 when Coke was trying to strike a deal giving the district $43 million in exchange for becoming the exclusive provider of beverages in the public schools. And back then, Karp is on record questioning that deal and the kind of message it would send to children and the impact on their health. So he supports the idea of taxing soda and encouraging and discouraging its consumption. But again, the question is, how does that impact his ability to judge the tax's role in the city's overall financial picture?
And with that, is Michael Karp planning to recuse himself from voting?
He told me he is planning to vote when PICA meets at the end of the month.
Thanks, Katie.
Thanks, Dave.
WHYY's Katie Culinary on NewsWorks Tonight. Delaware's Supreme Court yesterday ruled the death penalty unconstitutional. WHYY's Zoe Reed considers what that means for the court system and those on death row.
For years, Delaware activists and lawmakers have tried to abolish the death penalty. As recently as January, a repeal bill was defeated in the General Assembly. Brendan O'Neill, chief defender for Delaware's Office of Defense Services, says the 30-something suspects currently on or awaiting trial for murder charges no longer face the death penalty. The maximum sentence they can receive is life in prison. However, it is yet to be seen what will happen to the 13 individuals already on death row. New sentences will be handled on a case-by-case basis.
Each of those individuals is already represented by a lawyer. And the lawyers for those individuals, I'm sure, will be trying to figure out the best way to get the court to apply the Ralph decision retroactively.
He says Delaware's Attorney General's office could appeal to the federal courts.
There is the possibility of a review. It's discretionary by the Attorney General's office to seek this review, and then it's discretionary by the United States Supreme Court to accept the case for consideration.
He says if legislators wanted to reinstate the death penalty, they would have to create a new statute from scratch, one that ensures only juries can impose capital punishment. From the Delaware desk, I'm Zoe Reed, WHYY News.
SEPTA is close to coming up with a solution to fixing its damaged regional rail cars. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports that the repairs will still take a few months.
General Manager Jeff Knuppel says there are two proposed fixes for the stressed or cracked equalizer bars on the newest Silver Liner train cars.
One is a pinned foot where there's absolutely no weld at the top. It's kind of a seat that's made and machined that you would then bolt through to the end. And then the other style is the welded foot.
Knuppel says both fixes will be tested some 18 million times over the next week or so before picking which option to use. Andy Heyer of Hyundai Rotem, the company that made the cars, says they're doing what they can to fix the problem as quickly and safely as possible.
We've just been moving at lightning speed to try and get the design finalized and which direction we're going to go. Get the dynamic testing done so we can have the models correctly analyzed and calibrated.
Knuppel says about 10 cars are expected to be returned to service every week once repairs begin. In the meantime, extra rental trains will be added to the fleet around Labor Day when ridership usually increases. SEPTA will also supplement with new express bus service.
Five bus routes, express bus routes, that would only pick up at a couple stations and run on over to, let's say, the Broad Street Subway at Fern Rock or at AT&T. Those express routes will be a little longer, slightly longer than regional rail travel, but they will be priced at transit travel, so they'll be cheaper.
And how much is all this costing SEPTA? Lost revenue from fewer riders and paying to rent trains is costing about $1 million a month now, which is expected to get worse come September. It's unclear how much of that will be paid by Hyundai Rotem, since the train cars are still under warranty. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
Still ahead this evening, a new play opens about an all-time great Philadelphia Eagle.
He really did look like a little kid out there playing with all those giants. So if you're a 9-year-old sitting in the stands, of course he's the guy you're going to identify with. And I did, and all my friends did. We all love Tommy McDonald.
We'll hear about why a veteran Philadelphia sports writer decided to write a play about his childhood favorite when NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. In our culture that seems obsessed with appearance, girls from an early age get the message to stay thin at all costs. Sometimes that pressure results in eating disorders that cause a lifetime of misery and illness, often born in secrecy. Our commentator, Shannon Frost Greenstein, describes how she beat back her illness with lots of support.
Looking back, my eating disorder was part of my identity for so long that there was no way to discern where it ended and I began. It wrapped around and through me like the other half of a double helix. It was hard to think that things could ever improve from such physical and emotional misery. But looking forward, it seems impossible that my life could have reverted to such a dark place. Something significant happened between then and now, and he's currently 9 months old and teething. My life before him was a desperate search for relief and control, defined by mirrors and hunger and the worry I caused my support system at large. While I think I will always feel the remnants of shame about that, I can also say that my life since my son was born has been the most fulfilling, rehabilitating, and loving time I've ever known. I attribute that solely to the treatment I received at the Renfrew Center of Philadelphia, the country's first residential treatment center. I have had anorexia since childhood, which makes my recovery from more than 3 decades of abuse to my body all the more extraordinary. Practically a textbook study of anorexia, I exhibit the perfectionism, obsessive compulsions, and self-loathing that tend to characterize that particular eating disorder. There is anorexia within my nuclear family, and recent research is starting to emphasize the significant genetic component to eating disorders. I was largely unaware of the severity of my illness, even after I started purging what I ate in college. The next 10 years were a blur of vague misery as I met and married my husband, started working, and gradually became an adult. My eating disorder symptoms were cyclical, waxing and waning over time, always returning, and always slightly worse than before. At the age of 29, a perfect storm of biochemicals, circumstance, and the combined weight of 3 decades with anorexia led to rock bottom. Outpatient therapy, which I had been attempting for a few years, was not helping. Finally, my husband broke through my defenses and desire to avoid residential treatment. It was one of the most significant and valuable periods of my life. I emerged with a new perspective on my body, a new outlook, a restoration of faith in therapy and self-care, and a cadre of sisters in arms I met through treatment, several of whom remain my closest friends to this day. Treatment changed me, it improved me, and it saved me. Provided I do my part, provided I continue to work to keep the eating disorder at bay, dormant and subdued, provided I rely on my loving support network, I anticipate nothing but good things in my future. Good things for my child, for my family at large, and somewhat surprisingly, given that I never would have thought it possible, for me too. I'm Shannon Frost-Greenstein.
Shannon Frost-Greenstein is a writer living in Philadelphia. You can read more essays by area residents at newsworks.org/speakeasy. No matter how you parse the numbers, there's a shortage of pre-K classrooms in Philadelphia. By the city's count, more than 17,000 low- and middle-income kids do not have access to quality, publicly funded pre-K. Money from the new soda tax is supposed to help close that gap. But just because there's more demand than supply doesn't mean parents will necessarily rush to fill those new seats, as WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Aaron explains.
Parents, you've been here before. It's 5 o'clock, you're off work, you swing by the daycare center to round up the little guy before jetting home.
I'm here!
In other words, you've been in Darlene Williams' shoes.
I am here. Time to go.
Come on, man.
On a recent Monday, Williams' shoes are inside Candy's Kids Learning Academy in Philadelphia's North Kensington neighborhood. It's a small storefront operation, 2 levels, nearly 30 kids. Her 5-year-old grandson, Amir, started pre-K here 2 years ago when the center opened.
Say bye, Mr. Lawrence.
Bye, Mr.
Is he okay today?
Yes.
Okay.
Excellent. Have a good day, man.
All right.
Okay, parents, deep breath. It's time for the voyage home. Williams ferries Amir out the door, pivots left, and points to a house about 500 feet away.
Right where those yellow awnings are? So that's where we live at. You see how convenient it is?
No tears, no car seats, no struggle.
Yes, indeedy. It is very convenient, and I love it.
Amir used to go to a center about a half mile away. The care was good, but when Candy's Kids opened down the street, Williams took an immediate interest.
When I first seen it there, I was like, oh, a new daycare. That's interesting. And then when I went in there, I was like, yes!
When it comes to K-12 education, parents will spend an eternity shopping around for the best school. But pre-K is a different story. Years of research show that folks spend relatively little time looking for early childcare options, often less than a day. And when guardians do choose, they're more likely to prioritize practical concerns like location over quality, which can be difficult to gauge anyways. And that makes perfect sense, says Diane Casabuano, head of the Office of Early Childhood Education for the School District of Philadelphia.
Anybody who's ever had kids and a 3- and 4-year-old, you know, it's hard getting out the door in the morning. And, you know, walking to school with a 3- or 4-year-old is about 3, 4, 5 blocks, not much more than that.
And this right here presents a problem for big picture planners like Casabuano.
This is the map.
The map is a layout of Philadelphia dotted with little splotches of color dry erase marker, and each one corresponds to a pre-K site run by the school district.
This site here, looking good, mark it green. This site here, I think it's a watch site, mark it orange.
The shades signify how full each site is, and amid the swirl of colors, there's a lesson about the chaos of trying to track pre-K enrollment patterns.
You know, here, for example, there's a red and there's a green, and they, you know, are five blocks from each other. Here's a red and a green, and they're six blocks from each other. And that's where you really have to get into the neighborhood and say, what is happening?
When parents prioritize convenience, it can become really hard to match supply and demand. Say a new apartment complex goes up. Demand skyrockets, but only in a very specific neighborhood. And since most low-income parents are eligible for federal or state pre-K subsidies, there really isn't much of a difference in out-of-pocket costs between centers. So the trick, then, is putting pre-K seats in the exact places where parents will actually use them.
You really have to get pretty granular.
The city of Philadelphia wants to add 10,000 high-quality pre-K seats over the next 5 years. So how will officials make sure those slots don't lie fallow? For starters, says Ann Gemmel with the mayor's office, the city is going to do a lot of that detailed mapping.
We're not likely to partner with a provider that is, you know, located in an area that's already really well served. So that's a huge factor, but it's not the only factor.
The city also plans to reach out to families to convince them to think a little differently about choosing childcare.
You know, we're also working, building on the efforts of the previous administration to raise awareness around quality and the importance of quality and give parents the tools to recognize quality so that, you know, more parents would think about going a little bit out of their way.
And in this case, going a little bit out of the way could make a big difference for the city's ambitious pre-K push. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
This week, a legendary Philadelphia sports writer will make his debut as a playwright. Ray Didinger has been writing about the Eagles for almost 50 years. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that Didinger saved his personal story for the stage.
When Ray Didinger was 9 years old, he spent a summer vacation in Hershey, Pennsylvania, where the Eagles used to practice preseason. That's where he met wide receiver Tommy McDonald.
When Tommy McDonald joined the Eagles in 1957, he immediately became my favorite player. As he was pretty much every little kid's favorite player. He was the smallest guy on the team, and you all identified with him. He really did look like a little kid out there playing with all those giants. So if you're a 9-year-old sitting in the stands, of course he's the guy you're going to identify with. And I did, and all my friends did. We all loved Tommy McDonald.
That boy grew up to be one of the best football writers in the country. When Didinger became a voting member of the Football Hall of Fame, the first thing he did was to push for the induction of McDonald. McDonald had been one of the best wide receivers in the league. But that wasn't enough.
His career was an odd one. He bounced around a lot. He played for 5 different teams. A lot of them weren't very good. The Hall of Fame voters, they honor the guys that win the championships. They honor the guys that play for the great teams. And sometimes players who spend their career playing for the lesser teams kind of wind up getting forgotten. And I think that happened to Tommy.
Didinger's play is about his 10-year campaign to get McDonald into the Hall of Fame. It's called Tommy and Me.
This was our Sunday ritual.
The title of the play is also a list of its characters. Tommy's played by 2 actors, a younger Tommy and an older Tommy. Likewise, Didinger, portrayed as both a 10-year-old boy and as an adult.
I like the smell of the hot dogs.
And the hot chocolate.
Camel's little cans, remember?
Yeah, you used to burn your tongue every week.
Not every week.
In the play, the younger Ray is an unabashed fan, and the older Ray is an objective reporter. The younger Ray advises Ray as an adult on what matters most in the Football Hall of Fame.
That sort of tingle and excitement you felt going to the stadium on a Sunday morning, you're just so excited, you're going to the Eagles game, and you can't wait to get there. It is different than when you're going to the stadium and you got your computer slung over your shoulder and you're showing your press pass. You don't feel the same thing walking in the door. And ask yourself the question, wait, did I lose something here?
Didinger says he wanted this play to appeal to more than just sports fans. It has universal themes. But there will definitely be more excitement inside the Fringe Arts building on Columbus Avenue when Tommy McDonald himself will be in attendance. He is expected to see one of the 12 performances. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader, with additional production today from Ty Johnson. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.